Latham, thanks for the invitation. Okay, so right, so let me tell you what the problem is. I mean, the question. I mean, so the first question is a question of analysis. Is how you define the infinite products when they are divergent? So the question is something like this. Imagine you have a sequence of numbers, real numbers, going to infinity, and you should usually think of this sequence as spectrum of some Laplacian and some compact Riemannian manifold. And the question is how you define this product. Usually, of course, I mean this product is infinite, but you want to define it nevertheless. So the way to do this is to introduce this spectral zeta function, which is this one. I mean, we saw already a definition of this function in Mathilde's talk, and we know that for good examples, for many, many examples, definitely those examples coming from compact Riemannian manifolds, but other examples, this type of zeta functions are holomorphic or defined, convergent, absolutely convergent, for real part of S large enough. They have analytic continuation to the whole plane, and they are meromorphic. I mean, they have poles, simple poles at certain points, which we know more or less where they are. So in particular, they are regular at zero. So once you observe that using heat kernel expansion, then you can define products of eigenvalues as exponential of minus derivative of zeta function at zero. This is formally justifiable, this expression. So in other words, you can say log det of Laplacian is minus derivative of zeta function at zero, which is a regular point. So this is the definition I'm going to work with. So that's the zeta regularized determinant. This has many, many applications. This was introduced by Ray and Singer in 1950s, and it's used in physics, math, number theory, algebraic geometry, many, many places. Okay, so just as a kind of fun example, if you look at the original zeta function, which is Riemann zeta function, if you want to compute its derivative at zero, it's minus log of root 2 pi. So you can say that infinite factorial is root 2 pi. This is not a very simple calculation, by the way. This is quite tricky to do this. You have to use functional equation, you have to differentiate it, and you have to use identities for gamma functions, for zeta functions. It's quite a tricky calculation. And this is the simplest example where zeta, derivative of zeta, can be explicitly calculated. And the reason is that these expressions are not local. Unlike the values of zeta and residues of zeta, which are local expressions, derivatives of zeta are not local expressions. So anytime that you can really calculate these things, it's some magic has happened, which we don't know why, but this has happened. Anyhow, now, these Laplacians are usually D star D, where D is your Dirac operator, or half of the Dirac operator. And then, of course, you have this determinant map. So the determinant map, the way that we defined it, this log det that we defined, is not a holomorphic function. So this is a non-holomorphic function, obviously. For some reason, you want a holomorphic determinant. I'll tell you why we want holomorphic determinants. In some examples, like case of elliptic curves, you can write down these Dirac operators for elliptic curves. You can compute the spectrum explicitly, and you can define a holomorphic determinant. But this is not this determinant. And in general, finding holomorphic determinants is a very non-trivial matter. It's far more complicated than defining the original log det, zeta function, regularized determinants. So the Quillen's approach, Quillen tackled this problem exactly because of he was interested in understanding these holomorphic anomalies that people were doing in conformal field theory in the 80s. So he found the right mathematical foundation for that. So he introduced a line bundle. This is called now determinant line bundle. And he computed this curvature. And his curvature is actually corresponds to a holomorphic anomaly. So this Quillen's construction, the whole line bundle, his metric computation of curvature, then it was extended vastly in differential geometry, in index theory, in algebraic geometry by many people. So this is, this has been a quite successful paper he wrote. The paper is only about 4 pages, but this is the most amazing 4 pages I have ever read. It's just an incredible paper.
What is the Hubble? Is that, that's not an anomaly in the sense of physics.
It is anomaly in the sense of physics, actually.
What is a holomorphic anomaly?
Holomorphic anomaly means that there is an obstruction to fixing a holomorphic section to some line bundle. And that's where the anomalies come from. It's always finding a section for some line bundle. But all anomalies in physics are like that. There is no global section. So there's an obstruction to finding the global section, which is related to curvature of that line bundle. So, and then he computed the curvature. That's what it is. Right.
But then, in physics, anomalies are the quantum breaking of a classical symmetry, which is the symmetry that's broken by this.
It's conformal symmetry. Yes, that's
really conformal.
It is conformal anomaly, which is holomorphic anomaly, right? Conformal and holomorphic are the same thing, right? Okay, so. Now we took this idea and then moved it to the case of non-commutative tori. The original case of Quillen was for Riemann surfaces. And we have a Riemann surface of genus 1 in non-commutative geometry. We have a non-commutative Riemann surface, which is a non-commutative torus with a complex structure. So since, I don't know, maybe about 10 years ago, 8 years ago, working with differential geometry of these non-commutative tori, and then the complex structure has become kind of a program which has been going very, very, very well. Its calculations are quite hard, but there has been many successes so far. So I will indicate some of those things before going to the construction. So, I mean, okay, so non-commutative tori, that's the equation. We know what it is, and this is a smooth subalgebra. We know this is smooth subalgebra of non-commutative torus is the universal unital C-star algebra generated by unitaries U and V. And this is the smooth part, which corresponds to rapid decay Schwarz class functions. So that's the standard. Now, there are differential operators on this non-commutative algebra. These are derivations, which are on basic generators of the algebra. U and V are defined like that. And there is an analog of integration operator, which is this phi 0 is a standard trace on the non-commutative torus. On the smooth elements is given by picking up the coefficient of 0, 0 term. This is like computing the trace in Fourier mode. This is the Haar integral. This is in Fourier mode. So this is what it is. And then you can define a complex structure. Exactly like the case of elliptic curve, you fix a parameter, a complex parameter in the upper half plane. And then you define your Dolbeau operators just formally by these two expressions, which are taken from the classical case. So we have the analogs of Dolbeau operators, del and del bar, or del star operators. So you have an analog of complex structure. Then, as we've been discussing, in the two-dimensional case, metrics are only related to conformal changes of things. So they're conformally related. To consider all metrics, in other words, you can do the following thing. This is due to uniformization. You can fix a complex structure, pick a metric that gives you that complex structure, and then conformally perturb the metric. If you do that, you have considered all metrics on your elliptic curve. So that's exactly what has been done here by Kahn and Tretkov many years ago. And then they looked at the paper again, and then they could finish the calculation. So this was one of the definitions from their paper. So you perturb, when you perturb the metric by this kind of conformal thing, e to the minus h, h is a general element of the non-commutative torus, you get a new state on your C-star algebra, phi of a. This state, of course, is not a trace anymore, but it's a KMS state. And the KMS, the modular operator, bold face delta is just an inner conjugation by e to the h. This is a simple KMS state in this sense, which twists the trace property. So this is quite a standard calculation. So you have changed the metric, you have changed the volume form, and we can change the Laplacian as a result. If you change the volume form, you change the metric, you can change the Laplacian. The way to change the Laplacian that you take into account this new metric is you introduce a space of 1, 0 forms, which is a kind of Hilbert space you can introduce easily, this H phi is the GNS construction with L2, space of L2 functions on your non-commutative torus with respect to this new volume form. You do that. This is called GNS construction. It's sister algebra theory. And then there is a corresponding analog space of 1-0 forms. And then this del operator goes from H5 to H10. You take the adjoint with respect to this metric. So you just take the formal adjoint of this is an unbounded operator. You took its formal adjoint. It exists. And you get this operator. And then, as usual, you define this perturbed non-flat Laplacian. So this is the Laplacian that you want to analyze it. You want to do a spectral analysis of this Laplacian. OK, now the first question that was of interest was to prove Gauss-Bonnet theorem for this. And then also, if you are strong enough, compute maybe the curvature. So now the question is, how can you compute the curvature for this non-commutative space? Well, the idea of curvature really comes from Gilkey's formula. So we had, in the last two talks, these formulas, Matilda-Stokes and Akin-Stokes, these formulas were mentioned. If you write down Gilkey's formula and take it as an article of faith and bring it to this non-commutative world, you have a definition for scalar curvature in the non-commutative case. The scalar curvature should be an element of the non-commutative torus that satisfies this equation. This equation is one form or the other of Gilkey's formula for the second term of the asymptotic expansion of the heat kernel. This is completely suggested by Gilkey's formula. P is projection onto the kernel of the Laplacian. Now the question is, this somehow defines your operator, but then it's very hard to compute this term. I mean, because it just defines a functional that you can define the operator from, but in general, it's very, very hard to compute. So the computation was done using pseudo-differential calculus and other things, so I don't want to go into that. The final result for the computation, actually, there were two computations. One was done by me and my former student, Farzad Fatizadeh, and then independently, Khan and Moscovici, more or less, I mean, exactly the same time, did the computation. So there is an explicit formula. I just want to show this formula quickly and then move on. So this is the formula. For any value of theta, the deformation parameter, for any value of the complex structure k, for any value of the conformal parameter e to the minus h or 2h something, which I call it k, and then up to an overall factor, this element in the non-commutative torus computes the curvature that you can get from this Laplacian. So the element is defined in a kind of roundabout way, if you think about it. It's sums of three terms. There are some cohomological terms, like commutators. And there are anti-commutators of log terms. And this term corresponds to some kind of Laplacian. And so this formula, if you take the limit where theta goes to 0, approaches to this famous Gauss formula that gives you the curvature of a two-dimensional surface in terms of log of Laplacian of conformal parameter. There's a classic formula due to Gauss, so this formula reduces to that. This formula, there's no way to guess this formula by pure algebra. I mean, there's no amount of algebraic manipulations and definitions can take you to this formula. This formula is completely dictated by heat kernel asymptotics. It's completely is obtained. It's kind of, there's no way one could write down this formula based on some algebraic analysis, like connection, curvature, this soft differential geometry, never gives you this formula. I mean, it's impossible. So so these expressions.
But are you saying even in the rational case, which is more or less the same as the commutative case, you have to
In the rational case, we don't know really what's going on after these 4 years. Still, we don't know what's happening in the rational case.
You mean this is specifically for the irrational case?
No, this is the general theta. Oh, yeah. This is the general theta. But I don't know if the formula really simplifies if theta is general. Because multiplications are used, right, using theta, right? So just go on and simplify the formulas.
Yeah.
It's like a nice project, actually, by it. Yeah. But we don't know if it really simplifies or not. I doubt it. Because this is a function that we know its value like that, but over this just set of countable set, why it should simplify at all, I don't know.
OK, Okay, but is it continuous as a function of theta?
Oh, absolutely continuous, yes. It's analytic even.
But then it would be enough to compute it with theta being rational.
If we can, but it means that it's hard. It means that, that then even makes it hard to compute.
That's amazing, since it's Morita equivalent to the case state equals zero.
That's right, yeah. But curvature is, Morita equivalence is homological algebra, it's not differential geometry.
I see, okay.
Right. Okay, so the formulas for explicit functions for R1, R2, and W, these are explicit functions. These are explicitly computed in terms of cos hyperbolic and sine hyperbolic functions. So this is just what it is. Okay, so now I go now back to my talk proper. So this was the little bit of advertisement for what we did in the last maybe 4 or 5 years. So now back to my talk. So holomorphic determinants, how can you define holomorphic determinants? So imagine you have a moduli space or a space of connections or Cauchy-Riemann operators, some sort of operators. You want to define a holomorphic determinant on this space. So Quillen's approach, as I said, was based on determinant line bundles and curvature of the determinant line bundle. So let me tell you what determinant line bundle is. So one of the main ingredients, I mean, the first ingredient is a space of Fertom operators. So if you look at, if you consider two Hilbert spaces, H0 and H1, you look at Fertom operators between them. This is a very, very important space. If H0 and H1 are infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, this space is actually the classifying space of K theory. This zero should be up there, sorry. K0 of X is homotopy classes of maps from X to F. This is a standard result from K theory and index theory. This is all this due to Atiyah and Yannick, actually. So this space is very important. Its homotopy type classifies, essentially, it's classifying space as a set for K theory. But there aren't many natural vector bundles or tautological vector bundles on this space, so that if you have a homotopy map, homotopy of maps from X to F, you could pull back these tautological bundles and create elements of K-theory on X. There is no such construction. But there is one bundle over this. This is this Quillen's line bundle, which plays the important role for the construction, and I'm going to describe it. So the line bundle construction is, let us denote this lambda, the functor of H max for finite dimensional topic zero power functor for finite dimensional vector spaces. And the first result is that there is this holomorphic line bundle on this infinite dimensional vector space, determinant Fertom operators, which is like a complex Banach space. I mean, it's like an open subset of some huge infinite dimensional Banach space, such that this fiber over any Fertom operator is exterior power of kernel of T star, tensor exterior power of kernel of T star. This star is outside, this star is inside, and this is kind of, this is kind of multiplicative analog of index construction. The second is that there is a classical, there is a holomorphic section for this over F0. F0 is the space of Fertom operators of index 0. If you restrict your bundle over Fertom operators of index 0, then this has a holomorphic section, which is given, this section sigma is given by this very simple, innocent-looking formula. It's 1 if T is invertible, 0 is otherwise. So then what we do, we look at families of Cauchy-Riemann operators or Dirac operators, first-order elliptic operators over A theta, and you set up the question of computing kind of holomorphic, defining and computing holomorphic determinant for this. The set of operators that we took actually was suggested by this Kondratkov thing, family. But I mean, in that case, we just looked at del bar and del bar star. Now we add a family. We add a kind of gauge field, alpha belonging to A theta. So perturbations of this, so this is a first order differential operator. We add a zero order term, which comes from this algebra itself. So you look at this. So this A is a space of elliptic operators or Cauchy-Riemann operators for us of the form del bar plus alpha. Now we know that these operators are elliptic operators. If you define corresponding Hilbert spaces like Sobolev spaces in the right way, they really define two Hilbert spaces, and this D becomes a bounded operator, and in fact a Fredholm operator because it's elliptic between these Hilbert spaces. So it defines, so you get a map from A into this Fred space, a space of Fredholm operators. Then what you do, you pull back this line bundle over this A by this map. The map is kind of tautological map, it's map sending operator A to the corresponding elliptic or Fredholm operator, elliptic operator A itself, or dA, d alpha. So this is exactly like the construction that Quillen did. I mean, in the case of Riemann surfaces, once you have your Cauchy-Riemann operator coming from complex structure on a holomorphic vector bundle, actually, in that case, then you pull back this line bundle over a Riemann surface, over the moduli space, and you get this holomorphic line bundle. Now, there is a strategy to define this holomorphic section. And the idea was that you have this section, determinant section. So you have this section sigma. So now if you have a kind of holomorphic frame, if you have a holomorphic trivialization of your vector bundle, then what you can do, you can take this determinant kind of section, holomorphic section, which is not, I mean, this depends on choices that you're making. I mean, this is a section of a line bundle. It's not a function. That's the difference. This is a section of a line bundle. This is also a section of a line bundle. Both of them are non-zero over invertible operators. Then if you can write this in terms of that, you get a function. This function is holomorphic and is a function. It's not a section of a line bundle. It's a numerical function. And that's what we are looking for. Okay, so that was Quillen's strategy to define this holomorphic determinant function. Okay, so to do this, some things have to be done. Namely, you have to define this trivializing section for your determinant line bundle. To do that, you first put a metric on this line bundle, compute its curvature. Once you compute the curvature, you notice that the curvature actually is not zero. But you know exactly what the curvature is. So you go back and repair the metric using the value of the curvature, and you get a new metric such that the curvature with respect to that new metric is zero, and you have parallel transport with respect to that. So I'll explain that step. So the first step is to define a good metric on this. And here is where regularized determinants was used. So this is Quillen's metric. On the space of Fredholm operators of index zero, like the part that we are interested in, the metric is defined as essentially log of this norm squared is defined to be minus zeta prime delta at zero, which is determinant of delta. Delta, your Laplacian, is d star d. So the result is that this defines a smooth Hermitian metric on your line bundle, on your pullback of the determinant line bundle. So this is now the original result due to Quillen, as I said. Now, the standard computation is this. If you have a Hermitian metric on a holomorphic line bundle, then there exists a unique compatible connection on that holomorphic line bundle. This we know. So you can compute the curvature of that connection by using this formula, del bar del log norm of S squared, where S is any local holomorphic frame for your line bundle. This is a standard formula from complex geometry, holomorphic line bundles. So you have this section, and you have this metric, and you have that section, and you have this formula. The question is, you have to compute this. To compute this second variation of log det. Essentially, this is the second variation of log det. Norm S squared is det. This is really log det, and you are interested in, you want to compute the second variation of log det. And if you can compute the second variation of log that, you can come up with an explicit formula, then you have a go at your problem. So this was done, as I said, together with Ali and Oscar, my grad students, a couple of years ago, and maybe a year ago. It was completed actually recently. So the concept of the differential calculus was used, but let me not go into that. One of the things that we had to use, we had to extend this class of symbols that we used to work when we were doing the calculations for computing the curvature of non-commutative torus itself. We used a class of symbols, but that class of symbols actually is not enough. How much time do I have, Leighton, by the way?
15
Yeah. Okay, so that's good. So, yeah. So one of the things that we had to do, we had to extend the class of symbols. So consider, for example, a class of classical symbols. So classical symbols are type of symbols that have a homogeneity property and have a special type of growth conditions. So once you do that, the next step was to introduce a class of a kind of good trace on these classical symbols. So this trace actually, so you have certain traces on the pseudo-differential operators. You have Wojcicki residue, you have, which is also called non-commutative residue. But there is one kind of trace that became extremely useful for us, and it's normally not used in non-commutative geometry literature. That's the cutoff integral or Concewitz-Wisik trace. So the cutoff integral is an amazing idea. I mean, this is the idea that is kind of analytic continuation of trace. You see, if you have a pseudo-differential operator which is of order less than minus 2, so your manifold is two-dimensional. If you have a pseudo-differential operator that's order -2, if your manifold is d-dimensional, you have a pseudo that is of order less than minus dimension of the manifold, then we know that that operator is trace class, and its trace actually can be computed by this formula. This is a very classic formula. You integrate the symbol over momentum space. This sigma is the momentum. You integrate the symbol over the momentum space and compute this trace. This gives you a trace. But your operator, the operator that we were looking for, were actually not in this class. So then, there was an idea which was introduced maybe by others, actually maybe by Hadamard originally, but it was taken up by Concewitz and Wisik. The idea is that you can actually extend this sort of traces to all pseudos, and in the case of manifolds, to all pseudos which have non-integral degree only. And this is actually a trace. And the idea is this. So you look at the expansion of this trace. This is kind of cutoff integral. You look at the expansion over some kind of ball of radius r. So this is, imagine, this is ultraviolet cutoff, I guess, where r is going to infinity, right? So this integral is finite. And there is an asymptotic expansion for this integral in terms of powers of r. So there are some powers of r. There is some log r term because these symbols are homogeneous. They have singularities at zero. And there is a constant term. So the coefficient of log is quite well understood. This is this Wojcicki residue of this non-commutative pseudo. This was defined independently by my former student Farzad Fatizadeh. So this is his definition of non-commutative residue for this cons or classical pseudos over non-commutative torus. But then the thing that's suggested by this Concewitz-Wisik form is to look at this part, the constant part. So that was actually observed by Ali, I think, when he was reading the classic literature, on this Concewitz-Wisik paper. He said that something like this can be done in our case as well. So then we defined the cutoff integral of a symbol just to be this constant term. So this is this so-called canonical trace or Concewitz-Wisik trace. And the idea of being of non-integral degree in our case is not so crucial, I guess. The idea of non-integral degree becomes an issue when you are over manifolds and you want to have invariance on the change of coordinates. In the case of non-commutative torus, I don't think, because we are working with one global coordinates, we are using kind of periodic boundary conditions, and we are not changing coordinates at all. We are just working with one algebra of symbols all the time, and that's enough. So I don't think that's so crucial. So it's defined by this formula. And then one of the nice things is that this this Wojcicki residue, the non-commutative residue, actually can be defined as residue of this kind of cutoff integral or this Kontsevich-Wisik trace. So that's a kind of good interpretation of the idea of residue, because we always say that Wojcicki residue is a residue. Yes, it's a residue of a zeta function kind of thing. But here, actually, it appears as residue of a holomorphic function, which is defined in a different way. So this is one kind of approach to this Wojcicki residue through this cutoff integral. So, but that's not enough still. That class of symbols is not big enough for us, because the expression we wanted to compute is even more complicated than classical symbols. You extend the algebra by introducing these log polyhomogeneous symbols. These log polyhomogeneous symbols is the class of symbols that contain all those terms that we expect, and there are some log terms and powers of log terms. So this is due to the fact that sometimes if you are on conical manifolds, for example, you have conical singularities, or you have fractals, you have objects that are more singular than usual. And when you look at the heat expansions or corresponding symbols or corresponding zeta functions near singularities, they have some kind of behavior which are not captured by classical manifolds at all. By compact manifolds without boundary, compact smooth manifolds without boundary. So this is a larger class which is needed for this kind of very singular cases. This is this log polyhomogeneous symbols. And one of the examples of log polyhomogeneous is a log of, for example, Laplacian. If you have positive elliptic operators, pseudo of order Q positive, log of this operator is really one of those elements in this class. And that's one of the things we wanted to work with. So then you extend this Wojcicki residue and Kontsevich-Wisik trace to this class, which is given by this formula. So you look at this homogeneous term minus 2, 0 part. You integrate over momentum space over coesphere bundle 1, and then this is the analog of this non-commutative residue. Then the computation can be started or could be started. So you have to look at the two variations of log det and then compute the curvature form. So you look at the holomorphic family of Cauchy-Riemann operators. In other words, you assume that this kind of zero order term is a holomorphic function of W. W is a complex parameter. And you want to compute del bar del of this expression. So del bar del of this expression, which is given by the. So the first variation this is the result of computing zeta prime 0, second variation, sorry. The first variation is not very difficult, but second variation, there is a closed formula for the second variation, which is given by this non-commutative residue of log of Laplacian d inverse, it's kind of green function, and then variation of this times Dirac operator term. And you have to compute the trace of your this operator. This is a bounded, this is, we know, is a good element of non-commutative torus. You have to compute this trace. So to do that, using the formula that we had for residue, this sort of residue of logarithmic symbols, to compute that, you have to compute this residue density of this log of Laplacian d inverse term. This can be computed explicitly. So this was a quite hard computation, but this can be done explicitly in terms of elements, you know, functions on the momentum space and your original parameter alpha. So as a result, you get the formula for first variation of residue of log det, the inverse, is given by this formula. And the final formula that you get for the curvature of the determinant line bundle, so this was obtained by Ali, who is here, and Askar, my other students, is this. So the curvature of this determinant line bundle is given by this expression. This is just imaginary part of the complex parameter. 4 pi is 4 pi. Phi 0 is the trace, standard trace of the non-compute torus. This is the variation of D, and this is the variation of D star. So this term actually is a very well-known term. This term is a very well-known term. This is the symplectic form on a space of connections. This is the symplectic form. This is the standard symplectic form on moduli spaces of holomorphic structures on this line bundle. So this term is quite well understood. And exactly it's because of this that then you can go on and repair the metric, the original Quillen metric on the line bundle, by essentially multiplying the metric by this amount and define a new metric. And once you define the new metric, then you notice that the curvature of this new metric is zero. It's like this term minus that term, they cancel. Because the curvature is zero, you can fix a holomorphic section. Now you can fix the holomorphic section. So then that original strategy works. Namely, you had this original holomorphic section sigma. You have this holomorphic section sigma obtained by this method. And they are related by this holomorphic determinant. But the price to pay for this is you have to break the symmetry. You have to break the symmetry. To get this repairing, you have to fix a point. You have to pick a point from the moduli space. Once you pick a point, you break the symmetry. So you see that there is no. So this is the kind of explicit formula I was mentioning. So this is this new metric or modified metric, norm as f squared. It's given by the original, modifying original metric by this amount. But this amount, it depends on choice of a base point for moduli space. If you don't have that point, you cannot do this. And once you make the choice, you break the symmetry. So that was the, at the end, that was the justification that, yeah, there is no really canonical or natural holomorphic section for this line bundle. So the fixing a holomorphic determinant is impossible. And that was the justification for existence of conformal anomaly. You can define a holomorphic determinant, but not in a natural way. You just pick one D0. What is that D0? Nobody knows. So that's not natural. So that was the formula. So this is this determinant. This is a holomorphic determinant, in fact. But it depends. But it's not natural. It just depends on choice of this point D0. You have broken the symmetry of the problem completely. And in fact, the reason that you have broken the symmetry is that because moduli space is not this A itself. It's A modulo a space of gauge symmetries, right? So once you divide by the space of gauge symmetries, then this fix of D0 completely kills the joy. It means that this function doesn't descend to the quotient. This function does not descend to the quotient. You can define a holomorphic function on this kind of first thing, space of connections. But if you want to divide by the gauge group, by the big gauge group, the function doesn't go. This function doesn't pass through the quotient because you have to fix this D0. Once you fix this, this function is not gauge invariant anymore. So yes, the idea is that yes, there is no gauge invariant holomorphic determinant on this non-commutative two torus either. So that's what it is. So maybe I just go back to the theorem.
Well, this is very interesting. Why is it a disadvantage maybe you can compute something and it doesn't depend on this unnatural choice of the determinant?
No one has been able to do that. I mean, fixing a holomorphic determinant
for
a moduli space?
I don't quite see what's missing, because in this theorem, you seem to be able to handle the D. So.
Right. This works fine if you are over a space of all connections or complex structures. But if you want to divide by the natural symmetry group, it doesn't pass through that.
Okay.
It doesn't pass through the quotient. That's the obstruction, right?
You mean there's a precise question that arises in that setting and you haven't computed the answer to that yet because the determinant technique doesn't work?
Yeah, this was a concern for physicists, the conformal anomaly, whether it exists or not. I think this kind of mechanism made it clear to Quillen and others that there is a reason for this existence of conformal anomaly, and that's exactly the curvature of the determinant line bundle. So that was the reason, yeah. But the construction found many, many other applications later on. I mean, this construction is not just confined to Riemann surfaces. It was generalized to holomorphic families. I mean, when you have vibrations of complex manifolds by another complex manifold, and then to families in the exterior. So Bismuth, a lot of other people, Fried, a lot of other people worked on these things. Yeah.
I have a question about the infinite products of large numbers. So,
that's right. Yeah.
If it's arbitrary numbers, then there's no you don't know ahead of time what the answer is supposed to be. But if it's integers, then Glim has this way of taking infinite product of integers.
That's right, but he takes it as
and it's quite simple. You just keep track of how many powers of each prime number. What's the largest power of each prime number that occurs, and when you take finite products, there's a way of looking at an infinite product of integers. But does one know what this other product is? I mean, is there a simple formula for this other product? That would be nice to see.
Right. Does he get a number? Does he attach a number? Or the whole sequence is, for him, is a symbol, right? In the case of Glim.
The point is it's an infinite product. It's independent of the individual numbers. It's just, it's a single thing. For a finite number, you write it as a product of prime powers. Well, in the infinite case, you just write it as an infinite product of prime powers. Powers might be infinite.
Right. This is a real number. This is a positive number.
Yeah, well, sure.
That's what we get.
I'm just wondering, like, if it's powers of two, if you take the numbers 2, 4, 8, and so on, then is there a simple answer for this residue?
Oh, so the only case that I know that computed is was 1, 2, 3, 4 is infinite factorial, which was log of root 2 pi.
Well, that's the one you said.
That was the first example.
The one you said,
okay. Right, that's the first example. And then you can do some variations of 1, 2, 3 by raising them to power, because you know how zeta function behaves if you raise them to some power, these numbers. That's not difficult. But then the moment you do any kind of changes, it's just exceedingly impossible to calculate that number.
Yeah, but here's a precise question. If you look at the infinite sequence of integers, then the Grimm product only depends on the number of prime factors for each prime. And so there will be lots of different sequences of numbers which have the same Grimm infinite product. But it would be interesting to know if the residue is going to be also the same for those.
That would be interesting. Right.
The one you mentioned is going to be just all the exponents are going to be infinite. It's going to be 2 to the infinity, 3 to the infinity, 5 to the infinity, and so on.
Mm. Well, one of the things is one has to be careful, by the way, about this zeta regularized products is that there's no guarantee that this exists at all. I mean, given a sequence of numbers, you write down this zeta function. Okay, so if you have some control on the growth, you can assume that the zeta function is convergent for real part of s large enough, if you know the growth of these numbers. But there is no guarantee that there is an anti continuation. We don't know that anti continuations exist.
So you don't know?
We don't know that the anti continuation exists or not.
You mean only certain cases?
Only certain cases, yes. I mean, I don't think this question is in general answered. Given a sequence of numbers that are marching off to infinity, under what conditions the zeta function, this spectral zeta function, has analytic continuation and is regular at zero? There are two conditions. Must have analytic continuation, must be regular at zero. In order for...
It was very special sequences you were talking.
Yes, and for manifolds, this works. For singular manifolds, seems to work. And for a lot of cases, for non-continuous spaces, some non-continuous spaces seems to work. But in general, nobody knows what it is, really. I mean it's completely, it's a wild thing. I mean, it's completely a wild object. So we really don't know. I mean, that's actually right. I mean, that's, I'm glad you asked the question, George.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for coming. This is great. Thanks to the speakers and to the participants. Let me
also thank organizers. Let us all thank the organizers, Shane and Latham.